hearts. And I do note that H. Richard Niebuhr gave the Swander Lectures, I think, in the 30s, if I got it correctly. And he went on, survived all the search committees out there, I think, and went on to write books. So I'll let him be my model. It's a delight to be here. It's been too long since I've been on the campus. I think it was around 1980 that I was last on the campus, and it's just a delight to be back. We are in some ways sister institutions, Pittsburgh and Lancaster. In fact, some of our students end up serving in your area, and I'm sure vice versa. But it really is a delight to be here with you today. We're going to try to save a few minutes for discussion afterward. I know if I play this right, I'll provoke a lot of questions, and I doubt we have time to pursue them all. We do have a session this afternoon, and maybe we'll get a chance to converse more at that time. Today I want to talk with you, though, about faith at the frontier. And in fact, I want to begin with the observation that our faith really is out there ahead of scientific discovery and technological advance. The expectations of faith create the environment in which scientific research goes forward, and medical research in particular. People of faith, particularly Christian faith, but not exclusively, set the expectation that nature is rational, nature's ways can be discovered, and in fact, healing is part of the duty of people of religious conviction. God is a healer, it tells us in the pages of Hebrew Scripture, and if Christians somehow miss the point reading what we call the Old Testament, Jesus is labeled the good physician who went around healing the sick and commanding us as followers to carry on that ministry. Our religious faith has created this expectation of scientific discovery and of medical advance. It's an expectation which in many ways is lived out by the vocation of scientists, and particularly the vocation of medical service, the role of the physician, the role of the nurse, but also the role of the medical researcher. At the same time, our religious faith injects a certain amount of caution into that expectation. We do worry at times, precisely because of our faith, about where we're going with all of this, how far should we go, and even more profoundly, how far should we trust ourselves with this new knowledge, and particularly the new powers given to us by technology. So, well, on the one hand, it creates an expectation. On the other hand, it creates a certain healthy suspicion. How far should we limit ourselves, and how far should we regulate ourselves in order to avoid doing some of the mischief that might otherwise come? And in particular, Christian faith, I think, in our time, has taken it upon itself to speak for those who have no voice to speak for themselves. And here's where we get into, I think, the most difficult question that faces us in the area of embryonic stem cell research. Some among us take that duty of Christian faith to speak for the voiceless as including the duty to speak in defense of developing human life from the beginning, human life at the embryonic stage. I think all Christians agree we speak for those who have no voice. Does that include the embryo in the dish? Is that human life at its most vulnerable form? Or do we speak for human life implanted, or perhaps later in the course of its development? That's a question that is dividing Christians and certainly dividing the political landscape and dividing countries in terms of its public, their public policy. In fact, it's very interesting, in Germany, just in a day or two, I think it's this week, the German government, the Bundestag, will consider a revision to its stem cell research law. They're pretty conservative there, and it's not primarily the Christians that force the conservatism on them. It is the coalition of Christians and the Greens against the legacy of the atrocities of World War II that have created a pretty conservative research environment. And it is illegal to import into Germany. It's illegal in Germany to create embryos for research or to destroy embryos in the course of research. It is also illegal to import into Germany embryonic stem cells that were derived by other people in other places after a certain point in time. And I believe the current marker in time is January 1, 2005. There's a one-time extension of that to the present that is being considered by the Bundestag. And it's been very interesting because the Protestant bishop, Bishop Hubner, the bishop of the Evangelische Kirche in Germany, has come out in favor of this one-time liberalization. Put that in quotes, it's a very tiny liberalizing move, but this one-time liberalization of the law to allow science to import into Germany stem cells derived after the original cutoff date. His argument was, well, I began to talk to the scientists, and I began to realize what good could be done, and I began to weigh the benefits of that research over against the need to protect human life. And it came clear to me that it was appropriate to extend that. It set off a firestorm of reaction. The Catholics declared a new low in ecumenism in Germany, and it's just fascinating to watch that debate unfold in the context of the German situation. Meanwhile, there's an equally vociferous debate going on in the United Kingdom. In fact, I think church versus science relations have sunk to a new low, maybe only exceeded by the day when Bishop Wilberforce debated Thomas Huxley in Oxford and asked on which side he was descended, which side of his family tree he was descended from a monkey. The front pages of the newspapers in the UK, not widely read in the U.S., but front pages of the newspaper in the U.K., have been dominated by this debate, and all Christian voices, sadly, have been radicalized as speaking with one voice with the Catholic Church, and conversely, all scientists have been radicalized as speaking with one voice of secular humanists, if not outright atheists. And so you have this polarization in which it's almost impossible to stake out a middle ground. How did we get here? Let's back up and kind of work through this and just take the development of the science one step at a time, and then we'll come back to some of these issues toward the end. In 1997, as everybody knows, it was announced that mammalian human cloning was successful with the creation of DALI, the use of what scientists refer to as somatic cell nuclear transfer. I'm not going to say much more about that, but that's really the sort of the first breakthrough in that we want to start with today. Immediately on the heels of that, the next year, human embryonic stem cells were derived for the first time. And based on work that had been going back for decades with other species, but this was finally achieved using human embryos. Researchers were able to take embryos that had developed to about the five-day stage, when there are about 100, 120 cells, and derive from that blastocyst, that early stage human embryo, in vitro. In fact, these were embryos created for in vitro fertilization, but not implanted, embryos that would be otherwise discarded. Researchers were able to take that, cultivate to about 5 days, and then derive, through a fairly complicated process, derive what are known as human embryonic stem cells, or a better terminology, better term that should have been used right from the very beginning was pluripotent stem cells, human pluripotent stem cells. And a lot of the confusion that we are faced with today is a legacy of an unfortunate choice to label them embryonic stem cells, and the reason for that will come clear in a few moments. But in 1998, November, papers were published announcing the derivation of human pluripotent stem cells, the most notable way from human blastocysts. What is a human pluripotent stem cell? Well, you have to kind of imagine here the developmental process that takes all of us from a single cell fertilized egg, the embryo at its first stage, all the way through to where we sit today, or, well, I mean, you could include the newborn baby, but to where we sit today as a fully developed human organism. In that process of going from one cell to tens of trillions of cells that make up your adult body, there's not only multiplication of cells, one to trillions, but diversification of cells, or differentiation, cell differentiation. Cells go through a process of being committed to specific pathways. One can imagine a kind of branching out like a tree. And at the base of that tree, the single cell is labeled totipotent. Tota meaning having the capacity to become any, and potent having that capacity. But the word tota signifies the capacity to become any type of cell in the developing entire structure of embryonic life, including, and this is very important, including the cells that make up the placenta and the umbilical cord. At the very beginning, at least through eight or more cells, the developing embryo has the capacity of totipotency, capacity to become any cell in the entire developing body, but including the cells of the placenta and the umbilical cord. Once you get to the blastocyst stage, 100 to 120 cells, about day five, the cells of the inner cell mass, kind of envision the embryo now as kind of a cross-section of a soccer ball. We usually see it as a photograph that sort of shows it as a cross-section. If you looked at it from the outside, of course, it would be a closed ball, but envision it now as in a cross-section. Inside that soccer ball of cells, there is a clump of cells known as the inner cell mass. All of the cells now have lost totipotency, but these cells in the inner cell mass maintain what scientists refer to as pluripotency. That is, the capacity, and this gets to, then to the key of the definition, the capacity to divide indefinitely while remaining pluripotent, but also the capacity to differentiate and become any cell type of the human body, not including placenta and umbilical cord. So any cell type of the human body. Well, imagine a group of cells. I mean, if you could get them out of there, put them in a dish, and actually get them to survive in a laboratory, imagine that they would multiply indefinitely, remaining pluripotent, but that you could also take them and under the right conditions, watch them develop, in fact, tweak them along a pathway of development so that they become this cell type, that cell type, or another cell type. Various cell types of the human body, all of which, as you know, just consider your body for a moment, skin to brain to blood cells, to the cells of the organs of the body, all quite distinct, all expressing certain genetic factors, but all differentiated. It's the differentiated cells of your body that do the work, skin cells, for instance. But have you ever noticed how when you skin your knee, maybe you haven't done that for a while because maybe you haven't been on a bicycle, but as a child, you'd skin your knee, you'd put a Band-Aid on, 2 days later, you take the Band-Aid off, and new skin cells. Where do they come from? Well, the body keeps precursor cells in reserve, and it's almost as if a wound sends out a signal saying something in chemical language. It doesn't speak English, but chemical language, come and help me, come and help me. That signal goes out through the body, and precursor cells, cells that are far along the pathway, they're no longer, they're certainly not totipotent, they're no longer even pluripotent, they're not even what scientists are now calling multipotent. They've lost their potency. They've lost what scientists sometimes refer to as their stemness. They've gone toward differentiation, but they're not quite yet skin cells. But when the signal comes out, we need new skin cells on your left knee, those cells then come to the rescue, make that last division, and give rise to skin cells exactly where they're needed. And that's how the body heals itself. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could harness that capacity of the body to heal itself and repair, let's say, neurons that are damaged in a stroke or in Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. And that's exactly the great hope of stem cell research. Can we find a way to take these stem cells that we now can derive from embryos, these pluripotent stem cells, can we find a way to multiply so we have a virtually inexhaustible supply of these cells, but then differentiate them down the right pathway so that they could be safely injected into the body and allow the body's own mechanisms of signaling use those cells. In fact, the stem cells probably will signal we know they signal the body. We know they kind of add to the messaging back and forth between the damaged tissue and the inserted cells, that there's a message factor that goes back and forth there. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get the body to heal parts of itself that it doesn't seem to heal naturally? Or, of course, the great problem with stem cells is you lose them as you age, and particularly then the diseases of aging, when compounded with stroke or Alzheimer's, become almost impossible for the body to heal on itself. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get the heart to regenerate muscle cells, heart muscle, cardiomyocytes, after a heart attack, or the brain to regenerate brain cells after a stroke? That, again, is the extraordinary promise of this field of medicine. But it's not simply the idea that these cells will be implanted that's got biologists extremely excited. There are other things that are coming. In fact, our advancement in knowledge of basic developmental and cell biology over the last decade has been absolutely staggering and wondrous to behold. We have learned, we human beings, biologists in particular, thanks to a lot of very hard work, have learned extraordinary secrets of developmental biology. And the basic science has gone forward in just really wonderful ways. Another thing that's happened, or is just beginning to happen right now, is that these cells will create models for disease. If you want to test maybe suppose you have 1,000 pharmaceutical products, all of which you think might have a chance, maybe a very small chance, but a chance of being wonderfully effective in preventing Parkinson's, let's say. How would you test it? Well, you could create a mouse model, rat model of Parkinson's, but that's probably not going to get you where you need to go. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have in your dish, in the lab, a cluster of cells that would mimic the progression into Parkinson's, and then test your various pharmaceutical hypothetical substances against that in dish after dish after dish in the lab? That's exactly what's happening right now in pharmaceutical research. An extremely exciting new stage of pharmaceutical research. And it might be that we find that there are a lot of complex chemicals, biochemicals, that have been sort of sitting on the shelf. Nobody knew how to test them. That can now be tested as a result of that. So researchers in the field are extremely excited about various possibilities. The most exciting to the general public, of course, is, all right, I've got an injury, I've got a disease, cells in my body have been injured or destroyed or are dying or are impaired. Can you insert new cells that will give me a regenerated brain, or a regenerated set of heart muscles, or a regenerated liver, for instance? Can we regenerate cells and tissues and organs in the body using stem cells? A very, very interesting question, and quite possibly this will happen. In fact, today, interesting that we would pick today, the FDA has picked today to hold the first meeting to talk about this very question. What would we have to do before we could give permission to anybody legally in the United States to insert cells derived, pluripotent stem cells, derived from embryos and maybe other sources, pluripotent stem cells, into a human patient? It's probably a a ways into the future. But it is very interesting that already the FDA has recognized we've got to start thinking about the day when patients might be treated. You've all seen the pictures of lab animals with spinal cord problems, and then stem cells are injected and they're treated. Nobody claims yet to be able to do this with human beings. It would be unethical to try that now. The research simply isn't ready. But what will it take to get us there? Some of the difficulties that would be faced in meeting that challenge would be, first of all, to guide the differentiation from pluripotency to just the right cells that could be safely injected. If you were to put a pluripotent cell into a human body, very likely what you would be doing is causing cancer. And you can think how that would stop research in its tracks. And that's the monster in the room at the FDA as it meets right now. God forbid anybody early stage in this process causes cancer. How do we rule that out? If you put a pluripotent cell into a human body, very likely that's exactly what you'll get. In fact, that's one of the tests for pluripotency. Does it cause a tumor? But that's the great worry. So you have to differentiate that cell, that group of cells, which we'd be talking about hundreds of thousands, if not indeed tens of millions of them. But you have to differentiate those cells to the right point where they're safe to put in. They'll become exactly what's needed without becoming tumors. And you not only have to differentiate them, but you have to make sure that all of those tens of millions are at the same stage of differentiation. No pluripotent cells kind of slipping in. So the task is extremely difficult. So differentiation and purity at the stage of differentiation. You also have to address the question of tissue compatibility. If you put cells from just any embryonic source into me, chances are my immune system is going to react and throw those cells right back out, as it should. I mean, they would be regarded as an infection. And how do you overcome that? Well, you look for tissue compatibility, and you can get pretty far with that, but you're still looking perhaps at immune suppression drugs, and that is not a very good way to go, as anybody who's been close to a transplant patient knows very well. Life on immunosuppressant drugs is not a good way forward. So how can you how can you circumvent the problem of tissue incompatibility? Well, back now to DALI and somatic cell nuclear transfer. Some people have suggested that if you're really going to be able to do this, one of the things you'd have to do is create patient-specific embryonic stem cells or pluripotent stem cells. How would you do that? You'd start with a patient who needs the cells. You take cells from that patient's body. You'd use nuclear transfer to create then embryonic life. You let it go to only about 5 days, hence the term therapeutic cloning. You wouldn't let it go to the point where it could be implanted. It would not be reproductive cloning. You'd stop the process at that point, and you would derive, if you're lucky, embryonic stem cells. Could that be done? Well, nobody claims to be able to do it now. There's a report out in January of a lab in California. They published a paper saying we've actually succeeded in human nuclear transfer. Most of us kind of slept through that one. Has human cloning occurred? Well, if you take this lab's published paper, peer-reviewed published paper at face value, it seems like we have indeed crossed the threshold into successful human nuclear transfer. They actually got these cloned embryos to make it to about three and a half days, I think, developmental stage. But that's a cumbersome way to build a therapy. I frankly don't think that's going to be kind of mainstream therapy for most of us. You have to get donor eggs. Nuclear transfer is horribly inefficient at the moment. Somebody might figure out a way to make it more successful. Meanwhile, our friends in the United Kingdom, do you know what they're up to? They realize that, they think that they're at the forefront of this research, and in certain respects they are. What they have proposed and what is right in front of the government right now, I mean, what's causing this huge argument in the press in the UK is whether the government should allow researchers to use nuclear transfer to take human cells, maybe from a patient someday who needs cell therapy, but to take human cells and transfer that using nuclear transfer, but not into a human egg, which is in short supply, into a cow egg. And just this past week, about I think it was Tuesday or so of last week, a group at the in Newcastle in the United Kingdom announced that they had succeeded actually in taking a human cell, transferring the nuclear DNA into an enucleated cow egg, creating what some regard as a hybrid embryo. The technical term is cytoplasmic hybrid embryo, or cybrid is the recently concocted word, cybrid embryos. And they haven't gotten them to the point where they can develop them all the way so that they can derive embryonic or pluripotent stem cells, but they're moving along on that and claim, at least in the media, no published paper yet. This is a terrible way, by the way, to do science, as the scientists in the room know very well. You don't publish your results in the BBC, which is exactly what they did. You publish your results in a peer-reviewed science journal, and you make all the data available, and it's not regarded as a finding in the fixed sense until it's replicated by other labs. But they've gone ahead and right in the middle of this debate, I mean, they went ahead with approval, but the final government action is, I think, slated for about next month. And so it's got the people in the UK terribly distressed. What are you creating? Is this human life? I mean, I don't think anybody would quite dare to want to do this in the United States. I think it would hit kind of a revulsion nerve that runs through religious conservatives, social conservatives, and probably a lot of others as well, that we'd be creating this kind of a hybridization of human and non-human life. Meanwhile, the Brits are really divided on this. They don't quite know what to think of it. It has majority support, including the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. I don't think it had the support of the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, but it has the support of Gordon Brown, who, by the way, was raised, was he not, in the Reformed or Church of Scotland manse, and learned his theology, I guess, around the breakfast table. Is it morally right to create such an organism that is the result of the fusing of a human cell with an enucleated cow egg? Lots of technical questions arise at just that point, but we don't have time to go into them. But as you can see, the field is moving rapidly. I mean, it's moving today and this past week and this past month. The field is moving forward with a great deal of energy and steam. Meanwhile, there is a lot of work, a lot of very important and successful work that goes under the broad category of adult stem cells. I mean, if I'm the patient someday, I need, I've got spinal cord injury or stroke or suffered a heart attack. I need cells, stem cells to the rescue. The most efficient and medically elegant way of doing that would be to go to some place in my body, extract some cells, work with those cells, purify them, cultivate them, multiply them, and that's the really, I mean, that's an additional very hard step at the moment. Multiply them, and then put them back into my body. Nobody on the planet that I'm aware of would cry foul morally. In fact, I think everybody would cheer if medicine were able to do that. Nearly everybody would find that morally acceptable. And again, and it's also medically the most straightforward, the most efficient. So research into adult-derived stem cells is extremely important. Why then do we need embryonic sources? Because the whole field advances together. Someday we may be able to get cells from the patient's body, technically adult-derived stem cells, no embryo created, no embryo destroyed, but I don't think we'll get there unless we advance the whole field simultaneously. So we need, I mean, this is the contentious argument, but I'm prepared to argue that we need access to embryo-derived cells alongside adult-derived cells. But the picture is more complicated than that. Some have proposed that it might be possible to create a thing that is kind of like an embryo, but not really an embryo. It is like an embryo in that it grows and develops, and it has cells in it that have pluripotency, but it, as a whole, lacks totipotency. It will never develop into an embryo. Can you create such a thing? And there's been some success in this, but it's more of a proposal at this stage. Could you, for instance, modify the DNA in a human cell, the nuclear DNA, then engage in nuclear transfer? In fact, let's call it altered nuclear transfer, or ANT, A-N-T for short. Okay, altered nuclear transfer, genetically altered cell, nuclear transfer, put it into an enucleated egg. The egg is not an embryo, the cell is not an embryo, and you've altered it in a way that it never can develop as an embryo. Is it an embryo? And people of very keen intelligence and good conscience, including a lot of Catholic moral theologians, have said, yeah, that's okay. It never was, never is, and never can be an embryo. It's entirely a product of human technology, and it is morally acceptable to create this, to develop it, if you could, and then to take it apart or destroy it in order to derive stem cells. Altered nuclear transfer. Most commonly associated with the work of William Herbert of Stanford Medical School, a member of the President's Bioethics Council. Absolutely fascinating proposal. Meanwhile, however, the great breakthrough of the past year, which I kind of danced around, but now let's just go right at it. The great breakthrough of the past year has been in what is called induced pluripotent cells. Beginning with work done in Japan, but now building further in Japan, but also at the lab at Wisconsin, where the very first human embryonic stem cells were derived, scientists in both Wisconsin and in Japan have figured out a way to take cells, quite literally skin cells, put them in a dish, bombard them, load them then with carefully modified viral vectors, modified viruses so it doesn't convey any disease, but what it does is injects genes. Genes that are already in the cells, but the effect is to upregulate the expression of those genes. And what they've found is that if you upregulate the expression of certain genes that we've already learned as a result of embryonic stem cell research are upregulated in pluripotent cells. Study the pluripotent cells, learn what genes are kind of in overdrive that are switched off later, learn what genes are being heavily expressed, then upregulate them in cells that are from an adult, adult skin cells. You can fool these adult skin cells into behaving like pluripotent cells, almost as if they are derived from an embryo. In fact, they pass almost every test thrown at them in comparing them with cells derived from an embryo. Back at the very beginning, I suggested that wouldn't it have been nicer now, looking back, if at the beginning we just simply said pluripotent stem cells, some derived from embryos, some now by this process of induced pluripotency. That work was just published in November, and there is a race on around the world in labs to improve this technique of induced pluripotency. Again, just think how wonderful this would be if you could go to a patient's body, take cells, I mean, quite literally, no more painful than that, take cells from the skin, modify them somehow, maybe not even in as complex a way as has been demonstrated already, maybe a simpler way, modify them and create pluripotent cells, and then, of course, learn to develop them to just the right point in development. Very, very interesting to think about, but it's as if we now have a continuum that exists in nature between fertilization and full development as an adult human being with all of our highly differentiated cells. Your pathway through this is a process of cell differentiation. What's interesting is that scientists are now learning to manipulate that both ways, learning to take pluripotent cells and guide them in a process of differentiation so that they might be safe to implant, but also starting at the far end, finding cells and de-differentiating them, backing them up. So you have to think of this as a continuum that exists in nature, but now, as a result of these discoveries, becomes a manipulable continuum, and you can kind of slide the counter back and forth. More stemness, more differentiation, more potency, less potency, but more specific function. And as you slide back and forth, you can ideally maybe start here, back up here, and then maybe end up here and put those cells back in. That I think is the dream of the field. Well, let's wind this up by thinking about where we are in all of this. I mentioned the FDA is meeting today. There is a huge challenge in front of our society in how to put this research into operation, all the more complicated because we're in the middle of a political campaign. I think regardless of who wins, the United States will go forward with a more enthusiastic support for embryonic stem cell research. And it would be good to see the whole field, at least in my opinion, to see the whole field advance together. At the same time, nobody wants to advocate a policy that offends deeply the moral sensitivities of a decided minority, probably, of Americans. And a decided minority, almost a majority, deeply believe that embryonic life, even in vitro, even if it's going to be discarded, should not be the subject of experimental work. So whoever's elected president and the new Congress will have to thread this needle very carefully. In Germany, it's at a very conservative point. In the UK, it's at quite a permissive point. The United States, I think, is destined to be somewhere in the middle. That's just simply one level at which the debate will take place. But I think there are deeper levels, and here's where the church, I think, needs to play a role. We need to have a conversation about justice, not just in healthcare generally, not just in technology generally, but specifically about this area. How can we build into the development itself a commitment to the wide sharing of the benefits of this research? Our track record is not terribly good. We take an unbalanced approach to the burdens of research and likewise to the benefits of research. How can we get this one right? Second question I think that's in front of us is, how can we think about the long-term societal and I think existential and indeed religious implications of what we're dealing with? All the focus so far in my talk and almost the entire public debate has been on, well, where are you going to get these cells? Are you going to get them by destroying embryos? Or can you find alternatives? That's just a small part of the big discussion we ought to be having. We must also address the question of justice, as I just suggested, but beyond that, and informed by that, we need to ask the question, not so much where are the cells from, but where are they taking us? Where are we going with regenerative medicine? Will it be possible someday not just to treat, let's say, Alzheimer's, but memory loss that is a natural part of normal aging? I mean, when I think about that, it sounds good to me. Probably sounds good to most of us. Be able to treat natural decline, to regenerate the body cell by cell, organ by organ, tissue by tissue, unrelated to disease, but just as a part of the natural process of aging? Will we, in other words, begin to think of aging itself more and more as a pathological condition to be addressed by regenerative medicine? I don't see any way that we won't, because, baby boomers are just, you've seen the ads. We don't like the idea of aging. And if there's a potential here for a medicine, I think we will embrace it without even thinking about it. My view is that our role is not just simply to say no to things. I don't think that's the role of the church, to say no to this field of research or no to embryonic stem cell research, nor is it just simply to say yes to these fields, as if yes is the right answer. I mean, those answers are too simple. They're far too simplistic for the complexities of the debate. They undermine the deeper conversation that we need to have. We need to engage, I think, and enrich a conversation which, regrettably, just isn't going on. In fact, I think we need to start this conversation, but once it gets started, we need to engage it and to enrich it. A conversation that is too often neglected about where all of this is going. What are we doing to ourselves? Where are we taking this? What are we making of ourselves? How far will we go? Who or what, if anything, is guiding all of this? I think we really need to ask, what's the long-term future? What's the prediction? Not for our nation, not just for our nation, not just for the economy, not just for climate change. We also need to ask the question, what's becoming of humanity? What are we making of ourselves? These areas of research are opening up the possibility of the transformation of human biology as never before. What are we making of ourselves? I think there are three very quick points that need to be made in conclusion. First, I really hope that you and I can make the church a safe space for a difficult conversation. Take back the conversation from the religious extremists and the political operatives. Don't let them own the discussion about the status of embryonic life or the future of human life as a whole. Take that conversation into the church and create a safe space where people can ask questions, ponder, share their doubts and uncertainties, debate the deep issues, but not be driven to simplistic alternatives as if it's just yes or no. There's a huge space between yes and no. Create a place in the church where that can be pursued safely. It's nasty out there, and people need to have a place where they feel safe to reflect. Secondly, we need to recognize that the church today is just simply one voice among many. And I think this comes down to an act of faith on our part. Gone is the day when we call the shots. We need to grow up and recognize that. We no longer control the public order. That day is gone. The act of faith that's required, I think, is to trust somehow once again in the mysterious but sure ways of a providential God who is guiding things, not because the church is running things, but because somehow in the cacophony of voices, church being one in a pluralistic society, in that cacophony of voices, somehow there is a process of guidance. Oh, that's a huge act of faith. Do we trust in the providence of God? Well, I think it's just that. I think third point is the church really needs to be a place that calls attention to the theocentric level of the whole process here. It is not simply us and our technology. We have to ask the question not what are we doing to ourselves, but what might God be doing? Where are we in the moment of God's providential, creative, and transformative engagement with the creation? What is God doing in creating now through technology? And I'm so glad at this point to say that we're all part of a church and our lives are enriched by a church which has dared to say God is still speaking. Because to me, God is still creating. We're watching creativity unfold in front of us. And we need to dare to take the conversation to that level. Not just to create an open space, not just to hear all the voices, but to challenge all the participants to ask this question: how can we be obedient to the transforming purposes of God? Thank you very much. Do we have a few moments?
Oh, we have.
We do indeed. We have a few moments for a couple of questions. All right.
I want to note before we have a question or two that Ron Cole Turner will continue the conversation at 1:15 at the Hafer Center. Science in the Seminary, How Perspective Changes Everything. I think that's your title.
Context, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And we make it up as we go along sometimes. And I want to invite you to do that because many of you here, I think, who are seminarians, especially if you have a free hour or so, would profit from this because one of the things that ministers avoid most of all, from my experience, is science. Many of us in ministry are afraid of science. We think we have to be experts in order to be involved at all. And truth be told, I think we just need to know enough so that we can be good counsel to the folks in our congregation and to at least know where to refer. But I invite you to some questions here. Any questions? Yes, Lee.
I appreciate your field audits, but surely not every trend or series of events should be embraced as the providential acts of God. So I'm wondering, what are the criteria or what are the hallmarks of historical trends that we might want to regard as providential?
No.
How do you know providence when you see it?
Only retrospectively, I think, first of all, and I think that's the case in the Hebrew prophets, for instance. Looking back, you could say, gosh, captivity seemed like a very bad idea when we started out, but here's the providential hand of God in it all, and as humbling as it was. So it's obviously arrogant to read it off the newswire as if you can say, Berlin Wall down, apartheid over, score one for providence of God. I think we all did that. We said those are great events, but it's a little bit arrogant on our part to think that we can read it up close. We have to look at it. Naming it, I think, is something that can only be done retrospectively. How then do you live into it? How do you become obedient to its possibilities? There are certain benchmarks, and I think the critical one, of course, is justice. What does the Lord require? To do justice, to love mercy or kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. And the expectation of justice as it applies to technology is very difficult to work out. But having the voice persistently in the room seems to me to increase the likelihood that somebody 50 years from now will look back and say, well, they got it largely right. They moved largely in the right direction. Justice, healing, greater human community. I don't claim to have any new wisdom on what those marks would be, but I think those are the kinds of things we would point to. And again, living into it, I think, requires that we kind of take the temperature on each of those scales as we walk through these developments and try to hold the whole human community, scientists and religious and especially the politicians, accountable to these particular benchmarks. Extremely big question. Thank you.
I really appreciate
your invitation and call to engage in the conversation. At the same time, it occurs to me as we are conversing, science continues in its endeavors and continues in its progress. Not to mention there are those who would say there comes a point where talking is done and there has to be some kind of conclusions drawn, especially in the midst of disparate opinions and voices. I'm just wondering if you could reflect on where that leaves us.
That's a good question. Partly because of the difference that the Constitution makes. Compare the U.S. with the U.K. You said there's a moment when you kind of have to decide, and the U.K. is much better at that. I mean, their whole constitutional system is attuned to that much better. And there will be a day when Parliament votes, do we permit a certain line of research? There's no such mechanism. Well, I mean, theoretically, we've got such a mechanism, but as you know how things work in Washington, as I try to explain to my British friends, we have a constitution that is exquisitely designed to keep us from making mistakes as a nation. We still make a lot of them, but we keep us from making too many mistakes, and not much gets done as a result. What that means then is we are a largely unregulated country when it comes to science research, particularly of all places, reproductive clinics. And reproductive clinics can do almost entirely what they want. So donating embryos for research, there is no law at the national level that governs any of this stuff. The conservatives want a big law that bans too much. The more progressive voices in Congress want a more carefully drawn law, so they won't vote for the big one. The conservatives won't vote for the narrow one. And besides, the White House probably wouldn't sign it anyway, unless it's, of course, the bigger law. So you have, I mean, it's the classic gridlock in Washington. Meanwhile, everything is permissible. Hardly anything is funded in the U.S., so if you have independent funding, then you can go your own way. With the exception of some states, such as Pennsylvania. It's ambiguous a bit in the state law, but it is illegal to destroy an embryo for research in the Commonwealth. Scientists usually see that as, let's not test the law. Let's not go too far in that direction. So Pennsylvania is not on the forefront of embryo research. But other states have no such law, and in fact, California and some others have actively funded the research. So that simply compounds the problem of research sort of taking place all over the place. It is profoundly decentralized, and that only makes more difficult, I think, the challenge that Lee raised. How can we even dare to use the word sort of providential guidance in a radically decentralized research environment? A big, big question.
Let's have Josie, and then Anne, and then Reese to bring us home.
Okay.
And
I'll give very short answers. Sorry. Go ahead.
I'm very strongly in support of all types of stem cell research. I want to say that first. Okay. And strongly in support of healing when we can, and things like that, responsible research. But I keep having these nagging thoughts of, we don't know what the purpose of disease is, we don't know what the purpose of death is, really, or the aging process, or any of that. And as much as I hope this goes forward, I keep wondering what we are, I think that we're probably in danger of a very high form of hubris in a lot of ways, and we may dismantle things that are crucial to what it means to be human.
Yeah, that's an extremely profound point, and really well argued in some of the publications of the President's Bioethics Council. In improving human health, will we have somehow undermined our humanity? If you don't like that thought, read some of that literature. It really is sobering. You're absolutely right. On the other hand, there is something profoundly compelling, particularly when we were thinking about treating the diseases that affect another person. I mean, I might say of myself, I'm aging, I'm dying, I have a disease that can't be treated. God, in your mercy, teach me what you have to teach me. When I see another person sick, I don't say the same thing. I say something more like, can I help? Or can I find, more precisely, can I find somebody else who really knows how to help? How can we help you? So Christians, I think, are kind of torn that way. On the one hand, these limitations of life can teach us something. On the other hand, I would never want to say to another person, well, God has something to tell you by your sickness. Right? I mean, so we're really torn in that, and getting that balance right, I think, is a challenge.
I'm not sure what my question is, but I would like to hear you talk about how we balance the obligation to do no harm with the call to help, and how the natural propensity of cells to change fits into that. We have to rely on the ability of cells to differentiate, to make this work, to make our lives work, but it's that very propensity that also enables tumors and all sorts of nasty stuff.
Precisely.
So how do we work with this dynamic tool, not do harm and do good, when the very tool we have to work with has to go both ways?
Right.
I don't know what the question is, but I want your answer.
No, that's a very good question. And, and I don't know the answer. Now, in some respects, this is what they're debating in Washington at the FDA gathering. How can we set up a regulatory regime that makes it as sure as humanly possible that we will do no harm, but at the same time doesn't bottle up medical progress? Getting that balance right is extremely difficult, and, you know, I mean, pray for the FDA. It's not an easy job. But you're absolutely right. It's almost as if there is no line in nature between stemness or stem cells and tumors. I don't want to say that every stem cell is a potential tumor, but what we're learning about cell biology from stem cells is advancing cancer research profoundly, and vice versa. I've heard stem cell researchers say that they never talked to oncologists until about 3 or 4 years ago, but now they need to have the oncologist, the tumor pathologist in the room to help them identify what it is they're looking at in the dish. There really is almost no boundary line in nature between. So realizing that, as they do, they are extremely hesitant to ever put these cells into a body without test in other species and very careful work. But you're exactly right. That first do no harm hangs over the room at the FDA, I guarantee you, as a huge challenge. Do you have time for Reese?
I watched earlier in my lifetime various new technologies be purchased by companies that were in fact threatened by it in the area of alternative energy production. Wonderful patents came out and products, and they were purchased and then disappeared from the landscape. I'm wondering who else is arrayed here as a potential victim if these technologies go forward. I mean, there are pharmaceutical companies that are making massive amounts of money for drugs that might not be needed if some of these technologies went forward. There are large medical complexes. So am I just being paranoid, or do I think that some of this resistance to this technology is generated by financial counterinterests?
I have heard no one make the claim based on any evidence, that financial interests are funding political opposition. But you might be right. It probably is worth somebody trying to see if there is sort of a connection. I kind of doubt it, because there is... It's hard to predict exactly how this will play out. I mean, there is something for pharmaceutical companies. They're already heavily invested, at least some of them, in particularly induced pluripotency. I mean, this is just terrifically exciting, because you can take a known Alzheimer's patient, take skin cells, create pluripotent cells, create this lab in which you have 1,000 cell cultures all mimicking Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or whatever it is you think you want to test. And I mean, it really is an exciting new day for the pharmaceutical firms. So I think they recognize some advantages in the field. On the other hand, you're right. There are going to be, anytime anything big changes, there are winners and losers, and people are going to be very careful about this. One of the unfortunate things that's happened and just now been upheld by the courts is the Wisconsin stem cell patents, which were sweeping patents, were upheld in their full scope. I think there are 4 patents altogether, and I think they're still being litigated. But basically, it makes it very hard for people in the field to move forward unless they've got a team of lawyers working on the licensing question. And so it's intellectual property rights can slow down a field. On the other hand, bless their hearts, the Europeans don't like any patents that have the word embryo anywhere close to them, and so they've completely disallowed all of these patents, which means in Europe you're free to work on it, of course, unless you're in Germany and a few other countries where it's outlawed for other reasons. But in Belgium, for instance, or Italy, Spain, a lot of other countries, you can work on these fields, and you don't even have to worry about the Wisconsin patents. So it's an incredibly complicated, highly competitive field, and you're absolutely right. Money is always right at the door, and the at one door, and the lawyers at another door, and that does affect how the research goes forward.
Well, thank you, Ron. And I want to invite those.
Thank you.